What is road ecology? How are our roads driving certain species towards extinction? And what can we do about it?
Ben Goldfarb is a conservation journalist. He is the author of Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet, named one of the best books of 2023 by the New York Times, and Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter, winner of the 2019 Penn E.O. Wilson Literary Science Writing Award.
Ben Goldfarb, welcome to One Planet Podcast and the Creative Process.
Thank you so much for having me, Mia. I appreciate it.
It's not every day that I get to speak with a Rhodes Scholar. I'm sorry, you probably heard a joke.
Never before. That's the first time.
Well, you truly are. For me, I don't drive, so I knew nothing about road ecology before I read Crossings. But you write, when alien archaeologists exhume the rubble of human civilization, they may conclude that our raison d'etre was building roads, and I didn't realize some 40 million miles of roadways encircle the earth. It's kind of impossible to imagine life without these, as you say, asphalt arteries that connect goods with markets, employees with jobs, families with each other. Yet at the same time, the roads that unite humanity fragment nature, killing more creatures than many other environmental ills. Your book, Crossings, really does an excellent job of helping us understand the habitat fragmentation, direct mortality from collisions, barrier effects, chemical noise and light pollution, and all these other disruptions to species that are created by roads. Tell us about some of the roads you traveled in the writing of this book, and how can we reimagine our roads to acknowledge the right of way of other species that share our planet?
Wow, that's such a big and wonderful question. Reporting this book took me all over the U.S. and to other countries, including Brazil, Australia, Costa Rica, the U.K. It was really an incredibly rich experience to see all of these different locations and all of the different ways people interact with roads and with wildlife on roads. You know, one of the most inspiring places I often think about is Tasmania, which has the highest roadkill rates on Earth, in part because there's just so much wildlife there, lots of roads that wind through the bush and don't really have shoulders. Roadkill is just ubiquitous there. You can't drive more than a minute without seeing a dead wombat or wallaby or possum or pademelon. And what's fascinating about Tasmania is because it's Australia, the mammals are all marsupials, which means the females carry their young in a little maternal pouch. So what happens frequently, tragically, is that a female marsupial will be hit by a car and she'll die, but her babies, her joeys, will actually survive in that pouch. And so hundreds of people all over Tasmania go around checking the pouches of roadkill, looking for living orphaned babies to rescue and raise to adulthood. And I find that such a beautiful idea. Of course, it's very sad, but it's also inspiring. You know, here in the U.S., we're kind of roadkill blind, right? We look away from the dead animals that we see by the side of the highway, maybe because acknowledging them just reminds us of all of the carnage that we're personally causing in some cases. Whereas in Tasmania, people not only don't ignore roadkill, they actually pay homage to those animals by raising those orphaned babies. So I just found Tasmania an incredibly interesting place from a road ecology perspective.
Yeah, so much what we do, we desensitize ourselves, I guess because I don't have a car, so I don't think about it, although I've driven in cars, and of course we can't help but have received things through transport. I've heard it said that trees and water are a biography of this planet, but roads really, as you say, are how we've etched ourselves onto the history of Earth.
Yeah, absolutely. Those roads go back thousands and thousands of years. Many of our major highways in the U.S., in Africa and Europe and elsewhere, began as animal trails. You know, it was bison, largely, these giant lumbering herds of big shaggy beasts walking across the prairie and creating these lines on the landscape. And in Africa, it was elephants. And over time, those bison trails became Native American footpaths. And then they became wagon roads, gravel roads, and eventually interstate highways. So it's certainly true that we humans have kind of etched our signature upon the planet, as you put it, Mia, with our roads. In some ways, the creation of roads is this process innate to all beings. We all are inclined to create and follow trails. I think about hiking with my dog, and my dog is so trail-oriented. You know, she'll find any little path through the bush and just get on it, right? So this idea of moving along linear transportation corridors, there's something very animalistic about that, sort of common to so many creatures. We just do it at a much vaster and more permanent and destructive scale.
Talking about these different regions of the world, I've always been attracted to song lines. What we really need to do with our roads, I feel, is be more adaptive to the environment and respect the rights of ways of these animals who don't etch their roads so deeply.
I think that's exactly right. I also think we need to reconceive how we think about roads. I mean, we think about roads in the U.S. as these symbols of movement, mobility, freedom. There's so much about the romance of the open road and in our popular culture, going back to the mid-20th century when the interstate highway systems were built. Writers like Jack Kerouac were singing the praises of the open highway, and certainly roads play that role. I like driving. The iconic Western American road trip is, you know, like this wonderful experience. But, you know, I think that the purpose of this book is to say, yes, roads are a source of human mobility and freedom, but they're doing precisely the opposite for all other forms of life. They're curtailing animal movement and mobility and freedom by killing them directly in the form of roadkill, but also by creating these impenetrable walls of traffic that prevent animals from moving around the landscape and accessing big swaths of their habitat, right? So that's kind of the mental reconfiguration we have to go through, is to recognize that, hey, roads aren't just forms of mobility and freedom for us. They're preventing that mobility in all other life forms.
Yes, and there's some really heartbreaking stories. Before we go into that, I believe you'll share a passage from Crossings.
I'd love to. One of the passages I really like to read is about my time in Brazil. Brazil is an interesting country because they have lots of biodiversity and they also have lots of roads. They have, you know, one of the planet's largest road networks, and they're building more roads all the time. In the U.S., our major highway system is mostly constructed already, whereas Brazil is kind of doing that work now. But, you know, in some cases, they're doing it in a more thoughtful, progressive, enlightened way than we did in the U.S. and in Western Europe. So I just wanted to read a little bit about a really cool road that I visited in Brazil that indicates sort of a different relationship with roads and nature and human mobility. I was there with a woman named Fernanda Abra, one of the great road ecologists in Brazil, and she took me on this wonderful tour of the country, and we visited the road that I'm about to read about. On my last afternoon in São Paulo, Abra took me to see one of Brazil's most ingenious roads. We drove for hours through cornfields and sugarcane, the land crimping as we escaped the city's gravity. We slowed to pass horseback riders, their faces shadowed by straw hats. This, Abra said, was onde o vento faz a curva, an idiom that meant, roughly, where the wind makes the curve, the edge of the world. At last we came to Carlos Botelho State Park, a ragged parcel of Atlantic forest that had avoided Portuguese axes centuries earlier. Like many of Latin America's protected areas and many of the United States's, Carlos Botelho is gashed by a highway, SP 139, the road that connects São Paulo to points west. Rather than allowing SP 139 to rend the park entirely in two, however, the state had taken a progressive approach. As we neared the park, a sign warned that SP 139 was closed between 8 p.m. and 6 a.m. when animals were most active. Police cars, fire trucks, and ambulances could still drive through after dark, but otherwise the park belonged to ocelots and jaguarundis. There had been some complaining when the closure was announced, but people had acclimated and roadkill had plunged. The nocturnal closure wasn't the park's only masterstroke. One of road ecology's great riddles is how to get drivers to slow down. Motorists habitually ignore posted limits. Instead, we drive at a road's design speed, which is basically how fast the road itself wants you to go. Highways with gentle curves, wide lanes, and long sight lines have high design speeds. How often have you glanced at your speedometer on an open straightaway and been shocked to see the needle pushing 90? Our highways and cars want us to go fast, and we're helpless to resist. The virtue of slowness, the historian Gary Kroll has lamented, seems like an impossible dream. In Brazil, however, the dream of slowness lived on. On entering Carlos Botelho Park, we found that SP 139 was curvaceous and undulating, its bed rising and falling in waves like a gentle roller coaster. Signs warned of rodovia sinuosa. We were prevented from speeding not only by law, but by design. Practically every highway I'd ever driven on, I realized, was built to facilitate swift and seamless automobility. SP 139, by contrast, deliberately transgressed the conventional ideals of engineering, frustrating human users in service to wild animals. I just thought that was such a cool idea of creating roads that are deliberately intended to drive slow, an idea that really counteracts the purpose that roads certainly serve here in the U.S.
Indeed, we're moving so fast in terms of road ecology, you know, the internet superhighway and the AI. These pathways are accelerating our life in a way that might be dividing us from our natural habitats of community, because it just disconnects us from our more natural state.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. And it puts me in mind of what roads do in human cities, what big highways. And again, these are features that we think of as forms of connectivity, interconnection and exchange between humans. But you put a big urban freeway through the middle of you know, Los Angeles or Minneapolis or Miami as the federal government in the mid 20th century, and you destroy human communities, right? In so many cases, those roadways were routed right through communities of color, deliberately destroying those communities. And so you're exactly right. Those urban freeways especially have become these symbols of disconnection and segregation. They've divided those neighborhoods from the rest of cities and thus kind of strangled them. We have this idea that infrastructure, whether it's roadways or fiber optic cables or railroad, they're there ostensibly to connect human communities, but in reality, they tend to have the opposite effect.
And so the same things that are disruptive to many species are also, as you point out, disruptive to us. And you can measure that with health issues that we might have. But what I like there about the passage you shared and your book is it's also an invitation for imaginative recreation. You know, you talk about these wildlife overpasses. Infrastructure can seem like boring to people, but it's actually reimagining a different way of being, both for animals and non-human animals.
I mean, you're right that infrastructure is kind of boring to people. It's all around us, and so we hardly notice it. That's one of the things that attracted me to this subject in the first place. You know, roads are so ubiquitous, maybe not for you because you're a non-driver and that's so wonderful. But certainly here in the rural U.S., you really need a car to get around. We live in this fundamentally automotive landscape in so many ways, and if we don't interrogate it, it's kind of the water in which we swim. My intent in the book was to take that invisible infrastructure and make it visible and also to dramatize it a little bit. As you say, we think about infrastructure as being this fundamentally boring subject, and yet if you're a deer trying to cross a highway, that's the most terrifying, stressful, dramatic moment in your life, right? These roadways that we think of as so mundane are crossing paths with these animals who are undertaking the most incredible, challenging, majestic journeys as they migrate from one point of habitat to the next. My intent in the book was to reveal the drama associated with roads from the standpoint of wild creatures.
And could we go a little bit into talking about habitat fragmentation, but also the different ways, the noise, light pollution, the particles that come off the tires and the environmental effects for people to understand?
Certainly. I mean, you've touched on some of the big ones. You know, I think about road noise a lot because I think that's really kind of the perfect example of how roads affect humans and wild creatures analogously. We'll start with people. You know, road noise is one of the great unsung public health crises in human history. Road noise is elevating our cortisol levels, blood pressures, and heart rates, making us more susceptible to stroke, cardiac disease, and diabetes. There's an amazing study put out a couple of years ago, which compared neighborhoods in Paris and found that people living in the quietest neighborhoods lived 3 years longer than people in the noisiest neighborhoods. So road noise is literally taking years off of our lives, and yet we don't recognize it because we're so awash in it that we tune it out, even as it's literally killing us. You know, I wrote a lot of this book while living close to I-90, a big interstate highway that runs across the United States from east to west. I hadn't really even noticed it until I started reading some of the noise pollution literature and realize that, oh yeah, there's this constant monotonous hiss of the interstate in the background of our lives, and yet we don't think about it at all. And so when we moved to Colorado a few years ago, we prioritized finding a quiet street on which to live because it's just so startling and alarming. And then it's doing the same thing to wild animals, right? You think about a songbird who has to sing to attract a mate. And if your prospective mate can't hear you over the noise of engines and tires, you functionally can't live in that place, right? Or imagine being an owl who has to listen for mouse's footsteps in the leaf litter to swoop down and grab it. Well, if you can't hear those footsteps, that's a form of habitat loss, right? So road noise is just driving animals away from places they'd otherwise want to live, just as it's harming us as well.
It breaks my heart to hear about, you know, skyscrapers causing deaths amongst birds up to a billion a year in the U.S. alone. And there's kind of simple solutions, you know, if we don't look at everything from our point of view, you know, let's not have such reflective surfaces that disorientate the birds.
Yeah, absolutely. I've written a lot about that issue in other articles, and that's just such a heartbreaking thing to imagine, you know, these songbirds that are these tiny balls of feathers and the lightest bone, and they're making these unbelievable journeys from one hemisphere to the next, and for them to just die because they smacked into the window of a Starbucks or something is just the most depressing thing in the world. And you're right, it's such an easy problem to solve by putting up films that have little patterns on them so that the birds perceive them. The patterns are so light that they have no impact on human perception. You wouldn't really even notice them unless you were looking for them, but they can save lots of bird lives. That's the case with our buildings and roads. We know there are solutions, that there are things we can do to protect animals. When in the case of buildings, it's retrofitting some of that glass with those fritted patterns. And in the case of roads, it's these wildlife crossings, right? These overpasses and underpasses with fences on either side of them to guide the animals there. I just think about all of the infrastructure out there that's killing animals. You know, I'm working on this fish book now, and you think about dams. What could be more beautiful and sacred than a salmon's migration upstream? And then you throw up this giant concrete wall that just prevents them from completing that journey. And it's the most tragic thing in the world, you know? So everywhere you look, we're kind of frustrating animal journeys with our linear infrastructure. I think it's important to call attention both to the problem and to the solutions that exist.
Well, I do want to stay on crossings, but I didn't want to go into Eager because, of course, they're supreme architects and they're so fascinating, beavers. But what drew you to them?
I mean, in some ways, my interest in roads predates the Beaver book, but I grew up in New York and spent a lot of time in the Catskills and the Adirondacks, these big, relatively wild areas in upstate New York. And there are always beavers around, and I always had kind of a baseline appreciation for them. But I got really fascinated around 2014. I was living in Seattle working as a journalist, and I was looking for something to write about. And, you know, somebody sent me this advertisement for a beaver workshop. I didn't know what a beaver workshop entailed, but it sounded cool. So I went to this beaver gathering. It was amazing. It was one scientist after another talking about all of beavers' ecological benefits. Of course, you know, these are animals who build dams, and those dams create ponds and wetlands, and those ponds and wetlands are filtering out water pollution, attenuating floods, and mitigating against drought, right? They're these little reservoirs. You know, they're fighting wildfire. They're providing habitat for all kinds of endangered species. They're sequestering carbon, right? Beavers are kind of saving the planet in so many ways, despite our best efforts to kill them. They're saving us in spite of ourselves. That was just a really beautiful story because both humans and beavers are compelled to build, right? We're both constantly modifying our environment to maximize our own food and shelter. And yet we're doing it in a way that is fundamentally inimical to all other forms of life, right? And, you know, we're stomping out biodiversity everywhere you turn, whereas beavers are building in a way that promotes all other forms of life, right? They're these incredible agents of biodiversity, conservation, and restoration. And so I think that's the thing that unites these two books, is that they're both about architects, in a sense. One is about the world's most beneficial architect, beavers, and the other's about, you know, in some ways, the world's most detrimental architect, which is us.
And I think after fish, we have to think about bees because they're great architects as well and very imaginative and adaptive, as I've heard. Only one thing on beavers, though, but I heard there's a little bit of methane that's created through beavers, but I think it's outweighed by all the good that they do.
There's been a lot written about beavers and carbon budget, but I'll just point out that beavers are sequestering lots of carbon as well, right? Their ponds and wetlands are capturing leaf litter and insect bodies and sticks. They're kind of burying that stuff under many layers of sediment, all of that carbon-rich material. So they're capturing lots of carbon. When they release carbon is when they get killed. The pond drains and all of that organic matter at the pond bottom begins to decompose and is exposed to the air. And so to me, the carbon stuff really indicates the importance of keeping beavers on the landscape. When they're thriving, they're sequestering carbon. When we wipe them out, their ponds start to release carbon dioxide. And so that's just another argument for letting them do their thing without slaughtering them.
Yes, I'm pro-beaver.
I thought, and there are so many in France too. They're really thriving there. That's one of the things I've always wanted to do, is go to France and see some French beavers.
Yes, I saw one. It was a little bit of a story. Muskrat, I don't know how related they are to the beaver.
They're both rodents, but they're not too closely related.
Yeah, well, I thought I saw a beaver at a distance, and it was so cute. It was bathing. It was really, it was right there, you know, on the Île Saint-Louis. But then I got closer, and, well, it's a little less romantic, a giant rat.
Yeah, you know, like once a week, somebody sends me a video saying, hey, look at this baby beaver I saw. And it's always a muskrat. But muskrats are awesome, too. Muskrats are really, they're really cool critters, and they're doing important stuff as well. They're, you know, creating these little clearings within wetlands that become really good bird habitat, and they're building little lodges of their own that all kinds of other organisms use. So the muskrats are kind of a little mini ecosystem engineer, not quite as impressive as beavers, but you know, they're neat critters too.
And a lot of people don't realize that the wetlands over a long period of time are the greatest carbon sink.
Yeah, absolutely. Wetlands and mangrove forests. I mean, there's so much interest now in that concept of blue carbon, you know, carbon being, or kelp forests, carbon being sequestered within aquatic and marine environments. That's a really hot topic, as you say. And beavers are a huge part of that. They're just these wonderful agents of carbon sequestration, as long as we leave them alone.
Yes, it was one of the more heartbreaking stories is of what's happening to some mountain lions being separated, going back to crossings.
I'm glad you brought up that chapter of the book. That's one of my favorite chapters, and it's really timely right now. But, you know, there's this little population of mountain lions just west of Los Angeles in the Santa Monica Mountains, and they're kind of the archetypal road ecology problem in that they're this little cluster of animals surrounded by this ocean of freeways. They're kind of trapped on an island. They can't leave their little patch of habitat. They're hemmed in by traffic, and no new mountain lions can enter the population because of that wall of the vehicles on the 101 and the 405, some of the busiest freeways on Earth. Those mountain lions have become chronically inbred over time, and they're starting to suffer genetic defects as a result. So they really need to connect with mountain lions elsewhere in California. And fortunately, what's happening now is the state, in partnership with a bunch of environmental groups and private philanthropists, is building this giant wildlife bridge that's going to go over the 101 and allow those mountain lions to meet and mingle and connect these big patches of habitat and hopefully save that population. That's an incredibly hopeful story. And it's under construction as we speak. Just in the last week or two, the state has actually laid the first horizontal girders on the bridge. So they've already built the big embankments on either side of the freeway. And now they've actually put the girders horizontally over the top of the freeway. So it's now possible to drive under this overpass. And of course, in the next couple of years, they'll put dirt up there, shrubs and trees and rocks and logs and all of the habitat features that are going to make that overpass enticing and appealing to animals. So it's an incredibly exciting project. And to me, one of the most hopeful things that's happening in the US right now.
Yes. And what's the role of AI enhancing our ability to study and mitigate ecological impacts or wildlife monitoring, connecting animals to their habitats?
I mean, there are a couple of applications of AI that I'm aware of. One I'll mention is that there's a team of researchers in Portugal who have created a machine learning system that can actually detect and identify roadkill to the species level. So you mount this system on a car and drive around, and the AI is saying, hey, you know, there are three toads here and two birds there. And that's a powerful software because there's so much roadkill that we don't notice as humans, right? Yes, we see the big animals like the deer by the side of the highway, but we don't see all of those reptiles and amphibians and songbirds, you know, the really small creatures. And we know that roads take an enormous toll on them. You know, here in the US, as many as 300 million birds are killed by cars every year. It's just horrific to contemplate. But we don't really notice because we're cruising 70 miles an hour, perched in our little glass and metal bubble. So I think that in some ways, these car-mounted camera systems with machine learning software incorporated can help us figure out what we're killing. And then the other cool application that I just learned about this week, it's called an animal detection system, essentially. And it's basically this flashing warning sign. And, you know, traditional warning signs don't really do a whole lot. Drivers just kind of habituate to them and ignore them. But now they're flashing warning signs that only activate when there's actually an animal approaching the road. And so drivers are much more alert to that kind of thing. And there's some cool AI software that identify the different species approaching the road and only flash when a deer is approaching, not when a flock of starlings lands next to the highway or something like that and triggers the system. So that's kind of a cool idea, you know, sort of reactive real-time warning systems. I think that's a neat concept.
You know, I'm not a techno-optimist. I see a lot of problems.
Yeah.
But it is exciting to see how scientists are exploring animal communication or even the fMRI scans where you're able to attach it to people who might have locked-in syndrome or who are just in a study and they can intuit what they're seeing and thinking fairly accurately. So I don't know if that will ever be possible down the line with animals, but you could, you know, communicate. Now you have a right of way. You can pass.
That'd be cool. There's a great story in The Atlantic recently by Ross Anderson about efforts to use AI to communicate with sperm whales, potentially. And then the big question that the story posed was, okay, what would we tell them? I mean, I think that the first thing we should do is probably apologize for wiping them out and making their lives a living hell. But vehicle collision avoidance is one of the things we could talk about, right? We could say, here's where our shipping lanes are. And they can say, well, listen, that's also where our migration route is. So please avoid that spot. And then we'd have to actually listen to them. We're very good at that as a species. But I like that idea of using AI to communicate with animals so they can explain their needs and we can ideally adapt our transportation systems to avoid them. So that's all incredibly hypothetical and probably many decades in the future, but you know, a neat thing to contemplate.
But it is moving very fast. So yeah, I know that's
like
utopian idea. I also like to think sometimes what would it like a COP conference run by non-human animals would be.
Yeah,
the stuff they'd say about us.
Yeah, we would owe them a lot of loss and damage for sure.
And on that note, you had this interesting section about the phantom roads, where the sounds of roads were collected and just played back to birds.
Yeah, so that was a big noise pollution experiment. The question was just how harmful is road noise to animals really, right? Because, you know, the road has so many different stressors that it's hard to isolate any one of them. We knew for a very long time that birds avoided roads, but was that because of the noise? Was it because of the air pollution? Was it because of the linear clearing in the forest? Was it the traffic itself that they were fearful of, the vehicles? So what the Phantom Road Project did very ingeniously, and this was run by researchers at Boise State University, was they recorded traffic noise at Glacier National Park in Montana. So not a giant busy interstate, right? A national park, a protected area. And then they took those noise recordings and they played them through speakers in a roadless patch of forest in Idaho. And then they kind of monitored the response of migrating songbirds. And they found two things that I think are really worth highlighting. First, lots of birds avoided the area. They found road noise a turnoff. But the second one was that even the birds who did visit the area and kind of stuck around, when the researchers measured their body, they found that they were in worse body condition. You know, they weren't as fit. And the reason for that is you can imagine being a little songbird, right? You have to listen constantly for the sound of predators, the flap of an approaching hawk trying to eat you or a bobcat creeping through the underbrush. But if you can't hear those acoustic signals over the noise pollution of traffic, you have to look around for those predators instead. And as you're looking around constantly for hawks and bobcats, you're not eating as much. You have to be constantly vigilant. And that was kind of their hypothesis, that in the presence of all of this noise, these birds have to be so alert that they're not feeding like they should be. And so that just reveals how subtle some road impacts are. We all see the dead deer or raccoon or squirrel by the side of the highway, but we don't see the black-capped chickadee that lost 10 grams of body fat that might be enough to prevent a bird from completing its migration. Those subtle, sublethal effects are something a lot of road ecologists worry about a lot.
And it's great you highlight all these subtle road impacts in crossings, but I was wondering about your journalistic reporting. You know, you often incorporate voices from the local community, but has there ever been an experience where community involvement has influenced the direction of your reporting?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's almost hard to answer because it's like hard to think of a situation where community involvement hasn't dictated the direction of my reporting, right? I certainly write about communities different than me. There are chapters in the book about Native people in the state of Washington working to restore salmon runs, which have been cut off by roadways. And there's a chapter about the Black community in Syracuse, which is trying to remove I-81, you know, this big freeway that demolished their community back in the 1950s and 60s. And so if I go to those places and talk to those people without an open mind and say, hey, I know exactly what the story is and, you know, exactly who I need to talk to, that's the form of, you know, imperialism in a sense. Whereas I always think of my role as a journalist as being fundamentally a listener. You know, I go to those places and talk to people and then they tell me who else to talk to, where to direct my focus, what to read and to think about and what their concerns are. And so I feel like that's the job of the journalist, to talk to communities and then adapt to what they're telling you, you know, follow the story in whatever direction the people involved point you in. So I'd like to imagine my reporting is always influenced by those communities.
It's amazing how community-oriented your reporting is, but as you see firsthand environmental disasters, biodiversity loss, the impacts of climate change, especially on vulnerable communities, how do you approach reporting these challenging topics while remaining optimistic about the future of our climate?
I mean, I think like a lot of people who care about our planet, I sort of oscillate between despair and hope. You know, there are times when I do feel it's hard to find the hope for all of the reasons that Nadia enumerated in her question. There are just so many problems and the scale of the solutions doesn't always match the scale of the problems. I think about roads and it's like, okay, great. You know, we're building these wildlife crossings. Well, we've got 4 million miles of road in the U.S. alone and 40 million miles of road around the world. We're not going to build 40 million wildlife crossings, right? So the problem is bigger than the solution in that sense. And, you know, I think that keeps me up at night for sure. Look, I think the thing that gives me hope is just the number of incredibly smart, strategic, passionate people who I get to meet and talk to practically every day. I mean, I sort of conceive of that as my job as a journalist. Yes, it's listening to communities, but it's also finding those solutions. It's finding the people who are working to make our planet a better place. They're not always succeeding, obviously. And, you know, I think that reporting on solutions doesn't mean you're unilaterally chipper and cheerful all the time, because sometimes the solutions fail. But again, the fact that those people are out there, brilliant, dedicated people working to restore beavers or to reconnect the habitats our roads have fragmented. That's kind of what keeps me going, is just, you know, the opportunity to interact with all of these intelligent, passionate, solutions-oriented scientists and conservationists.
My name is Nadia, and I'm a student studying in Northwestern University's Specialized Media Campus in Qatar. Currently, though, I'm visiting my relatives in Toronto, and just recently I was in Ithaca visiting my friend studying in university there. But as my family and I drove across the Queen Elizabeth Way Road connecting Toronto and the States, I fell back to Ben Goldfarb's conversation during this agonizingly long five-hour drive. How roads are really this symbol of movement, mobility, and freedom, especially in North America, but how, as Ben Goldfarb mentioned, they're preventing movement, mobility, and freedom in all other life forms. We often take infrastructures for granted. Roads that inhibit what were once originally natural habitats, buildings that interrupt what was once a clear sky. And something that comes to mind when I think about this as someone who grew up in Hong Kong is our iconic neon signs. Hong Kong streets are dotted with countless neon signs. It's a spectacular sight, but also one of the contributors to us having the worst light pollution in the world. The natural cycle of night and day sends signals to animals regarding feeding and migration, so light pollution is really causing this disorientation and even death to animals. And because of this, the government has started taking down these signs. But I never noticed how culturally significant these signs were until recently when I visited Hong Kong. I went back and I noticed the landscape just felt entirely different. I actually grew up in a rural village in Hong Kong. They're ubiquitous all throughout Hong Kong, both the city center and the countryside where I'm from. They're passed down through generations in locally family-run businesses, designed with care and filled with history. They serve as this alternative to the expensive advertising billboards that are more common in other streets in outside of Hong Kong. So it's really a loss because obviously, we want to cut down on light pollution and make a better world for all life forms, but it's so much of what we're used to and what we have created culture out of. Like Ben Goldfarb mentioned, there are so many problems, and the scale of the solutions often don't match the scale of these problems. It's so easy to feel pessimistic about the future. Eco-anxiety is on the rise, especially in my generation. But at the same time, I think this anxiety is actually good. It shows the majority of us care, which was not the consensus in the past. Ben Goldfarb himself mentioned the mountain lions west of Los Angeles and, of course, beavers and how life throughout the planet. But at the same time, there are so many passionate people, like the people Ben Goldfarb talks to and interviews, but also Ben himself, who are trying to make amends to the natural world. It's amazing to hear from someone as inspirational as Ben Goldfarb, who's so dedicated to creating a beaver-filled future. Beavers are truly a beacon of hope. Now back to the interview.
Indeed. And your journalism is solutions orientated. It's difficult now with journalism being under threat. And, you know, where some people say we're entering a post-truth world.
Yeah.
So much misinformation and deep fakes and distrust in institutions. So what are your reflections on the future of journalism and how do you find a place in that to tell these important stories?
Oh, man. Yeah, that's another difficult one. I think that writing books is kind of like the niche that I'm trying to create for myself in some ways. But, you know, I think that there is so much journalism out there, a lot of it really incredibly good and wonderful. And, you know, some of it not so great. I mean, everybody's a journalist now, right? That's kind of like what social media has done. Anybody can report. And so you don't always know the trustworthiness and reliability of the people putting those tweets out there, those Facebook posts, right? We've seen the way that misinformation can be deliberately weaponized in all kinds of conflicts. And so my response to that was book writing, in a sense. You know, I feel like books are this weighty, authoritative, ideally very well-researched document that survive the news cycle. I think that's one of the challenging things about reporting now as well, is that everything just moves so quickly and the story changes so rapidly. You know, you put a story out there and then within 24 hours, it's been kind of buried by the next avalanche of digital content. So it's hard for any individual story to really make a big impact, especially when people like Donald Trump go around calling everything fake news, right? And so books to me just have this different kind of cultural valence and weight. You know, they live on people's shelves and they can be resources in the long term. You know, people give them as gifts to each other and they live in people's bedrooms in this very intimate way, right? So they just have this different cultural relevancy. And that's the avenue I've decided to pursue for those reasons. I think they just have a different ability to make an impact, at least compared to the magazine journalism that I do. Certainly no disrespect to all of the great investigative reporters out there who have made a huge impact on society with their work. Anyway, that's a long rambling answer that basically says, I don't know what I'm doing. You know, it's just an incredibly challenging news environment, and books are maybe my way of like recusing myself from the grind of daily reporting.
And you've also written environmental fiction in the past. So how do you choose those stories to tell from a more creative writing lens?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I wish I wrote more fiction, honestly, because it's really good, I think, and healthy for me in some ways. I mean, to me, the role that the fiction plays is it allows me to access ideas and emotions that my reporting gestures at but can't fully engage with. And one example I'll give is a few years ago, I had the opportunity to go to Mexico to write an article about the vaquita. But, you know, the vaquita is the smallest, rarest cetacean, you know, member of the whale and dolphin family in the world. There are very few of them left, and they're being killed as bycatch in fishing nets. They've been going extinct pretty rapidly in recent years, and we're unfortunately at enormous risk of losing them very soon here. And so I went down there to write an article about the potential demise of the vaquita, and it was incredibly sad. I, you know, also felt pretty helpless. You know, it's like I'm writing this article and I'm there to bear witness to the possible extinction of this wonderful animal, and yet what is that accomplishing exactly? You know, who's going to read that story, and like what policy change is that going to produce in actuality? You know, what impact is that going to have? It was sort of hard to imagine it having much of an impact. And I felt like I was just chronicling extinction without much hope of actually influencing the trajectory of the conservation efforts. And so I was thinking about it a lot while I was in Mexico, but couldn't really address in the story. That just wasn't within the scope of the article I was writing. So I ended up writing a piece of short fiction about a film crew who travels the world documenting the last days of these species that are going extinct and the grief and guilt they feel around that. So that was my way of processing that experience in the form of fiction, because again, journalism couldn't quite touch those emotions.
Yeah, we have to leave that space to be, I like the expression, gentle on our mind. So if we're, you know, advocating in our work, but also leave that space for the imagination. You know, I want to ask a big question, and maybe you don't have all the answers. I think none of us have all the answers, but they say that cities can foster so much change that ripples out to then more rural areas. And perhaps if we solve some of the problems in urban planning, energy, transport, waste management, food and pollution within cities, then maybe some of these highways that bisect wildlife from their habitats won't be so populated. So what are your reflections on what the cities of the future will look like in terms of some of those things that I mentioned?
I love that question. You know, certainly I agree with you that, look, we need much more walkable cities, bikeable cities, and cities that are just much better served by transit, right? And obviously Paris is kind of an amazing example of a city that has remade itself very rapidly, you know, oriented around bike and pedestrianism. And that's incredibly exciting. And I sort of applaud Mayor Hidalgo for that vision and approach. I wish that there were more American cities that thought along those lines. I think that for the most part, our cities, and certainly there are exceptions like, you know, of course, New York, and even, you know, smaller cities like Tampa and Cincinnati have done more for pedestrianism recently. But by and large, we have these incredibly automotive cities that aren't really served by transit and are becoming more car dominated over time. I mean, look, there are lots of things that, you know, we could theoretically be doing about that. I think that, you know, limiting free parking is a really big one. You know, we just kind of give away street curbs for cars all over the place. And of course, that incentivizes driving, right? If you know that you can easily park your car for free wherever you go, you're going to end up driving more. And if parking was less available or more expensive, that would disincentivize driving. So, you know, maybe one important option for creating livable cities and reducing American time in cars is just restricting parking. But, you know, it's one of the things I struggle with a lot, you know, and struggled while writing this book was like how radical to be in what I was prescribing. I mean, certainly I could call for a city like Los Angeles to do what Oslo did, which is basically ban cars in the urban core, right? But, you know, LA is not Oslo. It's just not going to do that. And I think I maybe sometimes erred on the side of being too pragmatic and not ambitious enough in what I was calling for. But I think about where I live in rural Colorado. You know, we live in the mountains and people just drive around to get to other communities in Denver and other places. And so it's just hard to imagine the kind of transit system that is going to get people out of their cars on a meaningful scale in Chaffee County, Colorado. And so in places like this, where people are going to continue driving, and we also have lots of elk and deer and moose and antelope and big animals that are impacted by roads, these are exactly the places where we need more of those wildlife bridges and underpasses to let animals move around the landscape. Because again, the main highway that runs through our valley is going to only get more trafficy. So I guess that's my kind of long-winded, uncertain answer is that, you know, in the cities, certainly we need better transit, more pedestrianism, better bikeability. And in the rural areas, we need those wildlife crossings. You know, we need to create a world where people drive less, but when they do inevitably drive, it's not as ecologically catastrophic as it is now.
Yes. So you're actually, yeah. I think, as well as being a great writer, you're just a great, I think, educator. I don't know how you engage with schools, but I think that making some of your books available to young people who may be weighed down with eco-anxiety or not knowing the solutions that are out there, there's a great positivity and you give certain roadmaps towards these solutions. So I'm wondering your reflections on the future of education, the teachers who are inspiring for you, you know, what are your reflections on that? Because so many young people are being educated for a future that they don't know.
That's another really lovely question, Mia. Thank you. I mean, certainly, you know, one of the things that really inspires me is just seeing how much beaver education is happening now, you know, in schools. You know, I do so many talks and walks and beaver viewing educational experiences, often for young people, for school groups. And that's just so much fun, right? Because the kids are always just so excited to see these animals or even just to see the landscapes that those animals create. And it is one of those hopeful stories out there, you know. I mean, we've been talking about all of the doom and gloom, but, you know, beavers are kind of an antidote to that in a lot of ways. I mean, here's this amazing animal that we nearly wiped out both in North America and Europe. And now it's making this great comeback. You know, we've had something like 10 to 15 million beavers in North America. And I think there's something like 100,000 beavers in France and many more in Germany and Sweden and Finland and other places. And so to me, beavers tell us that conservation works, right? That we can approach the precipice of extinction, but then pull back and say, hey, wait a second, you know, we actually do need these animals on the landscape and we're going to protect them and restore them and help their populations increase. And so beavers are proof that what we're doing as conservationists is not futile, right? That there really is reason for hope and optimism, which beavers demonstrate. And, you know, I think that's a really important lesson for young people to hear, is that you're not just entering this world of eco-anxiety and climate change and depression. You know, there are some really hopeful wildlife stories out there, and you can be part of that future.
Well, indeed. That's a future that I want to live in.
A beaver-filled future, yeah.
Thank you, Ben Goldfarb, for bringing us to consider the precipice so we can also consider possible futures, for opening our eyes to the realities of road ecology and for all you do to help us understand animals, fusing this scientific understanding with a moral call to action that inspires us to respect and live in harmony with animals. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you so much, Mia, for the wonderful questions and for all you do to make people love this beautiful earth that we all share.
One Planet Podcast is supported by the Jan Vyšovský Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Nadia Lam with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producer and associate text editor on this episode was Nadia Lam. One Planet Podcast is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Theme music is written and performed by Wanchan Chaz. We hope you've enjoyed this program. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast and be part of the climate change solution, just drop us a line at team@oneplanetpodcast.org. Thank you for listening.